Good evening.
Good evening.
Well, there's new faces. Are you here for the first time?
Yes.
Welcome. And you've been here before, you say. And you all have been here. Welcome. So, I thought I'd just give a little homage to the Lotus Sutra that we've been studying. And a few of us in here have been studying the class over the last 4 weeks with Catherine, and maybe a few more have studied the Lotus Sutra other places. I think I'll be talking about it in a general enough way so that people can appreciate where I'm coming from and where we're coming from and where why Buddhists have appreciated the wondrous Lotus Sutra for about 2,000 years now. So I've called this opening to the Lotus Sutra, or the Lotus Sutra opens me. And I came, maybe a few of us here at Santa Cruz Zen Center came to the Lotus Sutra late in life. Catherine has just now been teaching it earlier this year at the Monterey group, and now up here. I've looked at bits and pieces over the years because our founder of this Soto school in Japan, Dogen Zenji, who is quite a prolific writer, makes many, many references to the Lotus Sutra. So, you know, you see a phrase that says, you know, see chapter 2 of the Lotus Sutra, and you go there. And so I've read bits and pieces. And but over the last year, since I was driving Catherine to the Monterey class, it's really the first time I really took a good look at it. And I think for a lot of the time it was pretty academic, even though I enjoyed studying it with Catherine and the Monterey group. It's a little odd. It's the language is a little funny. You know, we look, for instance, Dogen, who I can say the same two things about, you know, there's a lot of translations, and you just find one that you understand, or you find something you understand in one translation and something else in another. The language is a little baroque in the Lotus Sutra. Things are a little bit grandiose. And, you know, the stories are, they're like Bible stories. I mean, the prodigal son, you know, no different than the one we studied in, you know, Mount Carmel Lutheran Church in the 50s, is right here, just, you know, with Asian names. So it's got this kind of, you know, biblical, parable, baroque feel to it that was hard to approach. One clue to it all, for the hugeness, the largeness, has been that according to Suzuki Roshi, our first teacher in America who came to the United States from Japan in 59 and founded the San Francisco Zen Center, and we have sprung off from them with Catherine. Suzuki Roshi taught that the Lotus Sutra was taught by the Sambhogakaya Buddha, one of the three bodies of Buddha. And I'll just go through briefly the three bodies, because some of us know it and some don't. the nirmanakaya is the flesh and blood body that the Buddha taught with 2,500 years ago, and that, you know, we can take on as in our flesh and blood as we study and as we embody the Buddha. The Sambhogakaya, the voice that's speaking the Lotus Sutra, is called the reward body sometimes. It's this karmic body, the body that we've inherited with our causes and conditions, that has just gotten, with our practice, we have been able to pay attention to the universe with our big mind. So it's got a little bit of a largesse built into it. It's Catherine first taught it, that it's that feeling that you get after sitting in one of our weekend or 5-day retreats where you've been following your breath and finding stillness and feeling the connectedness with the rest of the people in the sesshin, and extrapolating that out to sensing the interconnectedness of all beings. So this is our appreciation of the Dharma. And for me, kind of the motivator to keep coming back to my cushion. And then there's the Dharmakaya, which is the interconnectedness of all beings. It's sort of a non-perceptual, non-conceptual existence in the world, where without words, with just our consciousness, we are connected to all things. And of course, we're never not that. I mean, even as I talk now and I'm putting words together, I'm never not a part of that Dharmakaya or the interconnectedness of all things. But those are the three bodies. So if you can imagine that the largesse in the language of the Lotus Sutra is spoken by that body that just is feeling the appreciation for our existence, the universe. It comes from a big place, and I think the listeners, you know, for these 300 pages, Buddha is speaking to a cast of thousands and thousands and tens of thousands. I think the listeners of the sutra, and I think us, when we listen to the sutra, we are inhabiting our Sambhogakaya frame of mind. And so it just takes a while to sink into that. And Catherine talks about, you know, just reading it makes her feel happy. You know, so it you kind of pick it up and you find a place and you start reading for a while. And you get this buoyancy, this lightness, this openness, where, of course, stupas are floating in the air. Of course, flower petals are raining over world after world. Of course, you're conversing with human and non-human beings all around you. So that's kind of what one might experience. I'll give you a little bit here in the beginning. I'll I'll do some paraphrasing from the very beginning. This is what I heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying at Rajagriha on Holy Eagle Peak with a large group of great monks, 12,000 in all. All of them were arhats, without faults, free from afflictions, self-development, emancipated from all bonds of existence and mentally free. They included Ajnata Kaudinya, Maha Kashyapa, Uruvilva Kashyapa, Gaya Kashyapa, Nadi Kashyapa, Shariputra, Maha Moggallayana, Maha Katyayana, Anuruddha, Kapifina, Gavampati, and so on. The nun Maha Pajapati was there with her 6,000 followers, and the nun Yasodhara, the mother of Rahula, with her followers. There were 80,000 bodhisattvas, great ones, all free from backsliding, I like that, in the pursuit of supreme awakening. All of them had mastered incantations, taught with delight and eloquence, had turned the irreversible Dharma wheel, made offerings to countless hundreds and thousands of Buddha, planted roots of virtue, and were always being praised by Buddhas. Having trained themselves in compassion, they could enter into the Buddha wisdom, deeply understood great wisdom, and reach the other shore. Here's some more of the company that was there. There was Manjushri. There was the regarder of the cries of the world. There was great strength Bodhisattva. There was constant effort Bodhisattva. Never resting Bodhisattva. Jeweled palm Bodhisattva. Medicine king Bodhisattva. Bold alms giver, jeweled moon, moonlight, full moon, great power, immeasurable power. Four griffin kings were there, great dignity and virtue griffin king, great body griffin king, great fullness griffin king, thus willed griffin king. King, each with several hundred thousand followers. And this goes on for a few pages of all the bodhisattvas. The dragon kings were there, the chimera kings, the centaur kings. So, you know, that's the way it goes for 300 and some pages. And you know, where does that meet your life? Where does that meet your life? But, you know, it's pretty exciting. There's great excitement. Shariputra, you know, one of the main players mentioned in the first paragraph, he hears early on from the Buddha that he's going to become a Buddha. And then everyone else, all those hundreds and thousands of people there, one by one, they hear the prediction that they'll have their own ascendancy to Buddha. So you can imagine the excitement in the room. The Lotus Sutra is famous for its gender equality. The Buddha's women disciples, for the first time, are equal with all the others there among the throngs. They get their prediction of Buddhahood as well. So this was sort of a gender equality breakthrough 2,000 years ago. We hear all these new ideas. He tells us about, you know, we'd heard about the Theravadan small vehicle teachings and the Mahayana large vehicle. He teaches, you know, there's really the one vehicle, the one Buddha vehicle teaching. We get a new spin on nirvana. We hear about the lifespan of the Buddha, you know, many, many eons. And it's the first time people sort of, you know, they're seeing sort of the flesh and blood, but they hear for the first time that, you know, the Buddha has has really been there for many eons before and will exist for many more eons. We hear just about the whole concept of bodhisattvas, saving the disciples of Buddha, the students of the Dharma that have vowed to save all beings, and we're descended from that line of Buddhism. We hear about the arhats that were all there had heard that they'd been practicing for several lifetimes, and they were certainly practicing very hard now with the Buddha, and they'd finally gotten this arhatship. Arhatship.
Can we quote you?
There is an unconscious in case we ever doubted it. But, heretofore it had taken, many lifetimes. And then he starts, saying that, you can be a Buddha right now. And he tells the story of, the 8-year-old dragon girl who has just been made a Buddha. And I mean, my gosh, there's dragon girls in this. How can you put it down? I liked everybody is when they're told that they're going to become a Buddha, they're told what their name is going to be as a Buddha, and then they're told what the name of their Buddha land is going to be called. So Shariputra. Buddha saying, Shariputra, in a future life you will become a Buddha, honored for universal wisdom, with the name Flower Light. You will liberate innumerable living beings, make offerings to innumerable Buddhas, master bodhisattva practice, the 10 powers, and other virtues, and attain the unexcelled way. After countless eons have passed, you will have an eon named adorned with great treasures, and your world will be called free of dirt. It sounds like a cleanser.
Now a place for a gardener.
Yes. Or the flower light. But it's promised that it will be pure and flawless. I mean, who would have doubted that? But anyway, you have to get into this rhythm, and then this is where it all started making sense to me. I'd been studying it for several months with the Monterey group and Catherine, and I took a vacation to New York City, and think about the frame of mind you're in when you go on vacation. I mean, it's all about being open, being ready for wonder at every turn, so you're already in this special frame of mind. You're curious, and what is bigger than New York City? I was by myself on this vacation and doing lots of New York things, the shows, the restaurants, the hotels. I took a little 5-day cooking school, so that was a lot of fun, a nice focus for a few days. You're there with the hugeness, with the many, many tall buildings that might as well be floating in the sky. I brought the Lotus Sutra. Because as much as I like restaurants, you have to do something between courses. So you read, and so I was with the Lotus Sutra in this, this great wonderful Buddha field that I was really studying New York. So there was this wonderful place, if you know New York. This place called Highline Park, which is a wonder of landscape architecture. It's this elevated train trestle that goes about 50 blocks. And it's like five train tracks wide. And so it's pretty big, but it hasn't been used in 30 years. And about 6-7 years ago, rather than tear it down, they decided to turn it into a park. So they filled it up with dirt, you know, to hold trains. You know, it's about 4 feet, you know, deep of, you know, to hold up the tracks and the trains of iron. So they just filled it up with dirt, and it's beautifully architected, beautifully, you know, all the park benches are beautiful, the winding walkways, the plants are wonderful, and it's floating, you know, you're up above the ground, you know, so it's, you know, all of a sudden, the descriptions in the Lotus Sutra aren't so far-fetched. And you know, there's a part in the Bodhi in here, a famous chapter 14, where tens of thousands of bodhisattvas emerge from under the ground, the underground bodhisattvas, you know, saying, you know, to the Buddha, "Can I help you? Is there any, you know, what would you like me to do?" And the Buddha talks about, you know why these underground bodhisattvas have existed for several eons. And so, of course, what reminded me of that in New York City, but, you know, the subways. And there is a whole universe under the ground. There's the as Buddha, as the sutta says, the space underneath the ground is this universe that is very different than what you're experiencing. I mean, just the whole thing. I mean, there I was in kind of gay Chelsea, and you go down with all the gay guys, and you come up a few minutes later in, you know, Chinatown with lots of children. You know, it's like you've traveled a universe away, or you pop up in the theater district and you're surrounded by, you know, buses that have just come from Indiana, and they're coming to the shows. So it's this transformative experience. Going on the subways, and then I met a couple of true bodhisattvas underground. I got off, and there was this kind of college age woman helping this, you know, bleeding man who was next to one of the benches there, you know, and we were underground and it was stinky and hot, and she was trying to get, so I helped her get the guy up. And then there was another guy who came up, you know, with his cell phone and was calling 911. And he was going back and forth to the station, you know, getting the station master. And I was sort of giving everyone company, and they were doing the lion's share. But, they were really, I was on vacation. I had plenty of time. They were on their way from one place to the other, but really kind of took this time out to help this guy who had fallen for some reason or another, and really needed some help. Actually, he was incoherent, and you know, we waited till the ambulance came. So I met some underground bodhisattvas in person down there. So that's how I met. That's how I finally found myself really in the world of the Lotus Sutra, and inhabiting as much as I could with the help of my surroundings, my Sambhogakaya, my reward body, trying to keep that on the front burner as I explored the wonders of New York City. In the midst of of the Lotus Sutra and its drama and its color, its excitement. There is a very small pastoral chapter, number 5, called On Plants. And it's about plants and the forest. Maybe quickly, if we have time. I've only got 11 copies, so maybe you can share. This translation that we're going to be reading, it's translated the parable of the medicinal herbs. And the first line that we're going to be chanting is one of my favorite lines. And this one is a little bit harsh. It says, Dharma King is the destroyer of beings. But I like the translation in the Reeves book, which they call the Dharma King is the breaker of ideas of being. And I think I've mentioned that before. You know, this idea that we've all experienced by starting our meditation practice, you know, we just shift a little. Our ideas of how we are in the world, of how the world goes around, just gets shifted, it gets broken a little bit, and given another direction. And that's how I think of this first line that we're going to be chanting, that the Buddha is the breaker of our ideas of being. So maybe let's just read the first column in interest of time together. The Dharma King, destroyer of being, when he appears in the world, accords with the desires of living beings, preaching the law in a variety of ways. The thus come one, worthy of honor and reverence, is profound and far-reaching in wisdom. For long he remains silent and regarding the essential, in no hurry to speak of it at once. If those who are wise to hear it, they believe and understand it, but those without wisdom will have doubts and regrets, for all time will remain in error. For this reason, he adjusts to the power and power of preaching, taking advantage of various causes and enabling the person to gain correct view. Kashyapa, you should understand that it is like a great cloud that rises up in the world and covers all over. 8 more lines. This vision cloud is laden with moisture, and the lightning flashes and flashes, and the sound of thunder reverberates afar, causing the multitude to rejoice. The sun's rays are veiled and hidden. A clear coolness comes over the land. Masses of darkness descend and spread. You can almost touch them. And the rain falls everywhere. So he goes on to say that every plant, every tree, every bush accepts this rain according to what they need. Just what's right. It says over and over that the Buddha's teaching, like the rain, is all of one flavor. And no matter who we are, we just accept the Buddha's teaching, whatever we can hear at the time. And it's the fullness of it all. You know, you don't expect the the creeping vines along the forest floor to need a deluge of rain. It takes, you know, what's right there at the surface. The taller trees might need a little more water, and so they're going to be taking the rain that gets down lower. But it's all the rain of one flavor. Every being in the forest is getting just what it needs. Suzuki Roshi, our founder in 1959, and of course about a decade later, the San Francisco group was able to acquire the Zen monastery in Tassajara, Carmel Valley. So Suzuki Roshi told a student once that, you walk in the mist long enough, you're going to get wet. You know, there's something about, just showing up here at the Zen Center, just going to Tassajara for the weekend to sit in the hot tubs like a lot of us do when we're guests there. Just going there, you're going to start soaking up the Buddhist teaching. Reb Anderson wonders aloud how many people have come to study Buddha because of the good food served there at Tassajara. I go there with a friend every long weekend, Labor Day. So I was just there a couple weeks ago, and over the last couple of years, we've seen these two guys there from San Francisco, and we share a few meals there. One of them's a social worker, so we kind of share our job stories, and so he's been coming there for vacation for a couple of years, and he told me this year that at San Francisco Zen Center, he started going to San Francisco Zen Center just because he started sitting there on vacation at Tassajara and decided to check out what sort of its, you know, root, its foundation was. And I guess there's a program at San Francisco that it's like a teaching program for a year. You join it for a year and you're with a small group of 8 people and a larger group of, 100 or so, and each group of 8 has a practice leader that they meet with, the group meets. But anyway, he went through so here was this, fellow who, just started soaking up the mist at Tassajara, and so he's practicing at Tassajara in a little different way than he's started a few years ago. What I like about this story is this isn't a doing or an acquiring process. It's just, as Jean talked about a few weeks ago here, we just have to inhabit, our Dharma place. We just have to be in our bodies, being who we are, open with awareness of the world around us, and the Dharma, that mist, will start becoming, palpable in our lives. In the Lotus Sutra, if you build a stupa, if you circumambulate the stupa, you'll have your own Buddha field one day. But then he gets a little simpler. He gets down to the point where, if a child is just drawing a figure of the Buddha in the sand, that's all you need to have your own Buddha field. You just have to be a child. You just have to live in this body with this openness and awareness of the universe. And with gratitude, the Buddha said that Buddha's come to the world. The reason that he's there in the first place is That's not it. Well, Buddhas come to the world just to relieve suffering, so that we can experience peace and joy. It kind of takes. What's the poem about? You don't have to crawl on your belly, or you don't have to crawl on your knees. You just have to experience the soft belly of your existence. It kind of says, we're in this for peace and comfort, and the relief of suffering. Isn't such a bad deal. And then out of gratitude, when we're familiar with this, when we're relieved of our suffering, when we're familiar with the peace and comfort of this universe, in gratitude we for the children of the Buddha, I teach this great vehicle sutra. I assure such people that in the future they will fulfill the Buddha way. With their profound awareness of the Buddha, and because they practice, and because they observe the purifying precepts, they are assured of becoming Buddhas. Their whole bodies are filled with great joy, knowing their hearts and minds and their conduct. The Buddha teaches them the great vehicle. So it's not that we practice to become a Buddha or to practice to achieve great joy. We, at some point, are filling our bodies, aware of the universe, and our peace and comfort start us with this practice, with looking at the ethical teachings of the Buddha. It's this continuous circle. And just to finish up, to bring it out of New York City and the wonderful meals, to bring it out of a world that we might not always inhabit. Sometimes our experience isn't always of great comfort and joy, or the experience of being supported below by the underground bodhisattvas and the universe above. That might not be our all-pervading experience. And we've got two remedies. Like a lot of us who want to have a healthy life, we do a few things all the time to keep our health on the front burner. So if we want our worldview to be our Sambhogakaya experience, the reward body, our worldview to be the interconnectedness of all things, having our practice, Suzuki said, tranquility of daily practice is what we chant each morning. We have our practice on the front burner. We pay attention to our liturgical schedule and practice our ceremonies and our chanting. So that's our kind of ongoing reinforcement of this worldview of interconnectedness. And then we can also use it as medicine. When we're stuck, when we're caught, if we can remember to pause, to experience that stillness, fill our bodies once again completely, like the new battery-driven cars, will be charged up in 10 minutes to 80%. As a medicine. We have time for just a couple of questions, a couple of experiences. Maybe if you've been in the class the last few weeks, you've got a favorite verse or a favorite Lotus Sutra story. It's not about acquiring. It's not about doing or crawling on our knees. In the parable of the prodigal son, you know, the son who's been away for many years doesn't recognize his father, and the father offers him a job, and he just does the job. And when the father is ready, the father finally reveals his inheritance to his son. And the son says, when the poor son heard these words, having gained something that he had never had before, he was filled with joy, and he thought, without any intention or effort on my part, these treasures have now come back to me by themselves. That's the experience of just appreciating the cool mist as we walk through the fog. Thank you.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way.